Welcome, America. This is Eugene D. Colson at Mind Controlled America. If you watch TV, if you go to church, if you've been in the military, you are mind controlled at various levels. Myself, I was mind controlled the CIA, Operation Project MK Ultra, and Operation Monarch. I've been a part of this all my life. But I'm bringing on a special guest today. Roz, she's a Messianic Jew, and this woman has spiritual gifts. I know her personally, and I've seen God give her answers. Roz, are you there?
I'm here.
At what age did you know you had some kind of spiritual gift?
Well, I always knew that it was something different about me. I saw things in a deeper way than most people did, and I took a lot of flack from it. Because people are kind of afraid to approach you or be in your company. But I was young. I would say I was in grade school.
Okay. Now, did people treat you differently? Like push you away from them or some drawn?
I can't hear you. If you'd speak a little bit louder.
Did people treat you differently, some drawing to you, some staying away from you because of this?
They did. They did. Not that I didn't have some very loving people around me, but my own parents had this feeling about me. My mother used to say, I don't think you belong to us. She found me difficult, different, other, and she did. She was very hard on me.
Now, you claim that you can see angelic lights and so forth. At what age?
I do. It started when I had my music studio. I came downstairs and I saw a huge UFO, I suppose it was. It was huge with tiers and windows, and it was like a layer cake. It was very huge. And scary. And then some years later, I saw one in the area that I live in, and it came whooshing through the sky and hovering above my head. But this one was like a football. It came so fast, and I was really stunned. And it seems that no one else saw it in this town or the area that I live in. And what I had read was that you need to have an opening in the brain to see this. I don't really understand it from a physics point of view, but there must be something a little different about the way our brains work, those of us who see things in a deep way.
Now, you were an understudy of a famous musician.
Well, I was, yes. I had the good fortune to be the protege of Anatole Katane, who was a great Russian pianist, and took me as his only student, and I became a very accomplished pianist. And I did a lot of teaching, some concertizing, played with orchestras, and it was my passion in life. Music was my passion, and I guess my savior in a way.
Why don't you tell us how you met Anatoly Katane?
Well, it was strange. I was a music student, and I had a good teacher, and I used to go to Carnegie Hall and pick out the artists that were playing for that particular week or month. And then I went up to National Concert and Artists Corporation, who are the representatives of these artists, these pianists, and so forth, and I went up to get student tickets. We couldn't afford more. They were 60 cents, and we had good seats, and we saw the greatest. And one day when I was there, Anatole Katane appeared, came off the elevator, and I recognized him from the picture I had just gotten at Carnegie Hall, and I approached him. And I told him that I was a piano student. And he said, do you play like all the rest of the American pianists, all technique and no feeling? And I said, no, for me it's just the opposite. I play with great feeling, with a lot of sensitivity. And he said, you know, I would like to hear you play. And that's how we met. And I became his protege.
Didn't you have a friend that was with you when you met him?
I had a friend with me. And she was also a piano student, and she played the cello. And she told him that. She said, well, I'm not only a pianist, she said, I'm a cellist, too. And he said, well, I'm not impressed with people who play the whole orchestra. She was terribly annoyed, very upset, because I think that she was envious that he took an interest in me. And probably it was because I was down to earth, and I told him the truth, and that's how it was. And we became great friends. He was away on tour a lot, and I became very, very accomplished in his hands.
Well, tell us about when you were to play for him the first time, how that came about.
And when I played for him the first time?
Yes.
Yes, he told me to come to his hotel. He had just come back from a concert tour. He told me to come to his hotel accompanied by a parent. I was only 15 years old. And my mother and I went, and he asked what I was going to play for him. And I said, well, I had just played a radio concert, and it was the Brahms E-flat major Rhapsody. He said, oh, that's very difficult for a 15-year-old. I would like to hear this. So I played it for him, and he was pacing back and forth, and he said to my mother afterwards, he said, I never expected this. This is just amazing. This girl is hugely talented. And he said, I will make her a great pianist.
Yeah.
And, pardon?
Go ahead.
That was it. And, you know, in those days, even though he didn't ask a lot of money at all, it was still difficult. In those days, money is not like it is today. Well, maybe it's getting there. But, and so I became his student, and he expected great things from me.
Tell us how you learned to play that piece, why you picked that piece.
Well, it was a particularly difficult piece with a lot of stretches and chords, full chords, and I didn't think that he would think that he didn't think that a 15-year-old could play with such maturity and to be able to cope with it. It was a difficult, very difficult piece. So I played that, and then I remember playing other things, which I don't remember what they were, because he had me keep playing. And then he sat down and played a little, and my mother almost fainted because he is so magnificent. And it was a wonderful experience for a kid living in Brooklyn, New York, not from a wealthy family, and he could have had students from really great wealth. He was so well known and respected, and he took me as a student.
Well, do you think God had any involvement in you meeting
he
him?
He had to. And even though I desired a concert career, I knew that I was being led into teaching. And for the next lot of years, I became a pianist teacher. I went to Juilliard, and I learned to be a good teacher, and I was so successful with students. I have one now who is the conductor of the Oklahoma Philharmonic, Joel Levine. I had another one, Kenneth Hellman, who was Sting's accompanist and has played many concerts and got rave reviews, and it's been very rewarding.
Would you describe
I put my life and blood into it, you know, and it has been very rewarding. I've had some wonderful students.
Would you describe yourself as a very hard-headed, stubborn person?
Do I find myself hard-headed?
Yes.
Hard-headed? No.
Stubborn?
My mother said I was.
Okay, and for you, part of this thing to happen, you had a music teacher who gave you that Brahms.
It's a very humbling experience teaching, and I think God was using me in that direction, humbling me.
Now, You were in a religion when you were married to your first husband. What religion was that?
Well, I was Jewish. I am Jewish. And there, too, I was searching. I knew there was had to be more. And I started to read everything I could about religion, about spirituality, and so forth. But I did keep the laws of the Old Testament. Being a Jew and coming from a father who was very Orthodox, and so I did keep it, but I always suspected that Jesus was playing a part somewhere, although I didn't know what. And it was later, at a later time, that I accepted him as Lord and Savior.
Now,
and so I guess you would call me a Messianic Jew. And that didn't make me very favorable in a lot of people's eyes. They think of a Jew who accepts Jesus as a traitor to the religion. And I guess you are a traitor to the religion because you realize that we're now in a new covenant. And he's it.
Now, weren't you a Jehovah's Witness for a time period?
Oh, yes. I guess I like to forget that. In my search, somehow Jehovah's Witnesses came to my door, and I studied with them. And I did learn a lot about the Bible, but very selectively. They used the scriptures that fit their religion. I was stuck there for a long time.
Would you say that they twisted the scriptures?
Yes. They twisted the scriptures, and they only used the scriptures that fit what they wanted to tell you.
Now, would
very
they,
deceptive.
Would they discipline people?
Pardon?
Go into their homes? Would they discipline people? Go into their homes and see what they have in their house?
They came to my house.
I mean, would they go through other members' homes and just go through everything and see what?
Yes, they were always snooping on people, looking for some sexual sin or other kind of sin, and. And they disfellowship people that had to go before a committee who would judge what they did, and they would confess what they did. And if the committee didn't find them repentant, they would be disfellowshipped. And I did have a very dear friend disfellowshipped, and it just destroyed our whole family. That and the no blood transfusions in case of dire illness. And they lost children, and they are very, very adamant in what they want to control.
Would you say that they were trying to mind control their entire congregation?
Oh, people are definitely mind controlled Jehovah's Witnesses, and it's a shame because they are good people who are really looking for God and looking for a path and get stuck in this, and they're very nice to you until you become a member. And then you're under their scrutiny.
That's pretty much the way Worldwide Church of God does things.
Really?
And yeah. People can only parrot what they say religiously. Now, would they see things like in Jehovah's Witness, like they did in Worldwide Church of God? When you come into the truth and the way, you will lose your extended family. But we're your new family now. Would they say things like that?
Same thing. Same thing. I think all these cults that just have the know-how of how to control people, and good people, people that are really wanting to know God, they all work the same way. They have a society. You had a worldwide church, where this was a society, and they call it Bethel up in Brooklyn, New York, and they get all these young people to work for them and edit their magazines and write their magazines, and then they have their hierarchy, and people are terrified of them.
Did they have any sex scandals? Like in Worldwide Church of God, there was constantly having ministerial or evangelists having sex scandals, and it would be covered up. Have you seen anything like that in the Jehovah's Witness Church?
A handle? Did you say?
No, they would have sex scandals.
Sex scandals. Oh, well, yes, because this they can hold over a person's head.
No,
yes, there were sex scandals, but they covered them up.
Yeah, just like Worldwide Church of God, and they would say, well, would they have sermon say we can't talk about that?
Oh yes. It's very devastating, because when you if you ever get to the point that you realize that you're in a cult, it's very hard to get out, and it's very shameful.
Did you
because
find
by now you've lost all your friends, your family, and it's a very difficult thing.
Did you find that the ministers in Jehovah Witnesses were afraid of you in any way?
Well, I was one person when I decided to leave. I was one person they didn't go after. And that showed something, because they went after people that tried to get out.
Well, tell about, tell about your friend, I believe he's just still up there in New Jersey. You spoke with him earlier. What did they do to him? When,
who is this now?
The friend that you, the first one you talked about that was disfellowshipped and marked, and they destroyed him.
Well, there were a lot of disfellowship people, but I did have, it was a woman. I knew of a man too, but the woman, they devastated her life, you know, because they had her confess. I guess they caught her in something that was, could be exposed. And she had three children, and they all had to learn about this, and it destroyed her marriage, and it made her a very sick woman.
Now, you have another couple that had a retarded son. What did they do to him and her when they left the Jehovah's Witness Church?
You're talking about a friend Vincent that I told you about?
Yes.
I don't think that they, no, they didn't have a chance to defellowship them either. There was another couple, they did not have that chance. And today, Vincent is of course, far away from Jehovah's Witnesses. He left years ago. And they don't care about you. So he was not disfellowshipped, but he never went back, of course. And he what he did was expose what they are. There are websites now by ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that tell the true story and what was done to them, if anybody wants to look that up.
I believe the man who started the Jehovah's Witness Church...
a Pastor Russell.
Oh, I think, well, the guy who started the Skull and Bone Society, our Rasta friend... A number of years later, he started Jehovah's Witness Church.
Yep. I think he was also a Mason. And the Bible that they used was done by a Spiritist.
Now, when they give their sermons, would they say, well, we're giving you special knowledge that no one else knows?
Well, it was only Jehovah's Witnesses that would make its way into the new world. Everybody would be destroyed.
Well,
except them.
Like Worldwide Church of God, that's what they'd say. They'd be taken away to a place of safety during the tribulation. And their whole message was, we have to create a warning message. And
mm-hmm.
We, as members of Worldwide Church of God, for the most part, we'd look down on churches and charities that actually do things for people. Like
see, that's another device that they use. They look down on everyone else, every other religious denomination. It's only them that is going to make the new world.
Well, you know, I've seen it on the internet. I've talked with people that were mind control victims. They were Jehovah's Witness Church, like Worldwide Church of God, and its offshoots are front organizations, from what I've heard and been told, for mind control victims.
Would you speak up?
The Jehovah's Witnesses and Worldwide Church of God are front organizations, and there have been countless mind control victims coming out of them, claiming satanic ritual abuse, CIA mind control, sex
mm-hmm.
party, satanic ritual abuse. Now, you were in politics at one time.
Yeah. Whenever your mind is given over to a hierarchy, that's what happens. You become mind controlled.
Now, you were...
They know how to work it.
You were in politics at one time. Why don't you tell us about that?
I was in politics. to my own surprise, I was always a community-minded person, and I served on a lot of boards in the town that I lived in, scholarship committees and the Board of Health and et cetera, worked in the school system, and I was called by the Republican committee in the town and asked if I would run for office. And I said, "But it's very ironic. I'm not a politician." They said, "Well, that's why we want you, because we know that you love this town and that you're not a politician." And so, innocently, I got involved and I was elected to office and became police commissioner besides being a township committee woman. And I was as naive as could be. I guess I always had that streak in me, and that's why I got involved with Jehovah's Witnesses. And when I started to see the dirty tricks of politics...
Wasn't that about the first time you saw that tiered UFO?
I saw the UFO after I was out.
Okay.
Oh, in politics? Yes, I probably was in politics when I saw it.
Now, when they took your picture with everyone else, when you first became police commissioner...
Sorry, I'm not hearing you.
When they first took your picture when you became police
commissioner... When I was inaugurated, they took pictures. And over my head was a halo of light. And I thought that they would faint. They were terrified of this. And they said, "Well, maybe something was wrong with the camera. Let's take another picture." And they took another picture, and there I was with a halo over my head, all these people standing next to me with nothing. And at that moment, they became very afraid of who I was. I wasn't even aware, really, of that kind of spiritual gift I was given. I wasn't even aware at that time.
How many pictures did they take?
Oh, three or four. Every time I was there with that halo over my head, big bright white light, and they were scared. I had a very rough time in politics because I fought for justice. I fought for what was right, and they didn't.
Now, didn't they move everybody around in different positions on each of those pictures?
What's that?
Didn't they move everybody they were taking a picture of around in different positions while they were taking the pictures?
I don't remember. All I know is there were other people. There was a bunch of people, Republican people, that were at this inauguration. And
now, tell us about the corruption you saw at...
it was all the good old boys. Because that's who they put up for office, those that they control. I was somehow, they didn't know who I was. They figured I was just a housewife, didn't have any big titles, and so I would be easy to control. But they always appoint people and run them for office who they know that they have control over. They're usually the good old boys. They have a long-standing family background in the town, and they work together, and they get deals done, and they do very suspicious things. And they hire an administrator who is in their pocket and has a conflict of interest. It was too much to go into. And I was so devastated when I saw this.
I went
in as an idealist, and I came out so disappointed. My son said to me, "Mom, your whole belief system was blown." And that's what happened. From that moment on, I became very jaded with politics and the people in it. And, of course, when my term was up, I ran.
Would you say that they would gang up on you and try to steer you in a different way?
Oh, they did try. Certainly did try. They threatened me that I would be sued if I didn't go along with certain things they wanted to pass. and the certain people that wanted special favors, and that if I didn't go along with them, that I would be sued, and this is the kind of thing that they work on with you.
Now, you hired a police chief to clean
Pardon?
The, you hired a police chief to clean up the police department.
We did. We had a police chief for many years who was a total alcoholic. And he let the cops do whatever they wanted. They had free rein. Well, somehow, the other good person on the committee and I worked to have a new police chief. He was a graduate of the FBI Academy. He was educated. He had degrees, and he was as straight as could be. And we hired him, and he revamped the police department to his own detriment because the cops all went against him. You can't imagine the carryings on that went on there. And they did everything in their power to get him fired, break his contract. And, of course, it was successful because even the judge that heard the case was corrupt. Those judges are elected, so they owe their loyalties to these characters. So you don't stand a chance. And they blackballed him. After they fired him, they blackballed him all over New Jersey.
Would you say that they were using mind control techniques on the general public by the way that they were disseminating the news about this and so forth?
You know, the people don't take an interest. They really don't. They don't come to meetings. They don't take an interest. They don't know what's going on. The papers are very slanted and twisting things that happen. And the people really are in darkness. They don't know. And they don't care to know. You know, this was a bedroom community where people commuted to work every day, came home 7, 8 o'clock at night on the bus from New York. And they're exhausted and they have family problems. And they count on this. They count on nobody showing up. Nobody testing them. Nobody trying them. They count on this. And they look at the public as being stupid, which they are.
Now, while you're
and
up
they,
there...
They can do whatever they want.
Now, while you were up there in New Jersey, was there something in the sky you saw that was around you continually?
Not louder.
What, did you see something in the sky that was around you continually?
You know, I really don't hear you. I'm sorry. I lost you.
Let me try this.
Try again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, did you see something in the sky in New Jersey that was around you constantly? Like a green orb? A green orb up in the sky outside your home?
Oh, well, yes. When I was alone, I was in the middle of a divorce. Every single night, a green orb would be over my house. And I used to kid around, and I'd say, oh, look, I have somebody protecting me. Look at that green orb up there. And when I met Harold, my present husband, he noticed it also. And as soon as we married, the orb went away. And I said, it was there to protect me. I still feel that way.
Well, now, you and Harold eventually moved to Florida. Is that correct?
What's that?
You eventually moved to Florida?
We eventually moved to Florida.
And
here is where I saw the second UFO. And then I started to see what I call angel lights all through my house, all around me. And they've been around you, too. And they stay for, about 15 or 20 minutes. And they're just like dancing all around the house in all colors. I don't know what it means, but they're there.
Now, there was a period of time several months ago where you and I could not formulate short-term memory or sentences. It was difficult to even talk. Why don't you describe that?
You mean the time that we couldn't speak?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that was.
I mean, we both had the symptoms at the same time. And I've shown you the bruises, the marks, the needle marks, the claw marks on my back, you know, each time I find them when I wake up in the morning. Why don't you describe that a little bit?
Right. Oh, I do see that, yes.
Now, I have been told by my contact that they were poisoning us because they wanted to separate us. Because Roz has spiritual gifts, and I've seen her get inspiration from God. It's the real deal. And, you know, we've come to the conclusion that one of your neighbors and the one across the street are involved in the occult. You know, the neighbor and her house sells at the same time your house sells?
Mm-hmm.
In a real estate downturn market? Now, I have been told that she has done... run people away from looking at your house when it's for sale. What have you heard about that?
About what?
To keep people from viewing your house while her house was for sale when you were not home. Didn't she yank people and say, hey, come look at my house first? This is much better.
She would, when customers would come to look at the house, she would pull them into her house, which is really a no-no. It's very rude, and it's very cruel. And that's what she would do, pull them into her house.
Now, you, being in your search for truth, you did a lot of years of research on conspiracy theories and whatnot.
I can't hear you again. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
You did a lot of research on conspiracy theories. Why did you start researching conspiracy theories and mind control?
What did you say?
Why did you start researching conspiracy theories and mind control?
Well, I think it was because of my past and what I allowed myself to get into, easily swayed at first. And then when I met you and we really talked about it, we realized that we were really practically the only two people in the entire town that were awake enough and cared enough to research these things. And you,
now,
of course, have been a victim of it.
Now,
in a large way.
Yeah. Have you seen evidence of seedy people coming around us, say, when we're having coffee at Starbucks?
Well, we usually meet at Starbucks. There isn't too much to do in this town. And one day, I noticed a man glaring at you, and I didn't like the looks of him. There was something about him, because I'm very astute with people. I didn't like the looks of him. And then he came over to really where we were sitting and glared at both of us. And I said, I'm afraid that this man is up to no good. He's got something very evil about him. And then you can tell the rest of the story.
Well, at that point, you know, she said she was describing this man, and I turned around and looked, and he had walked beyond the Starbucks windows, heading south. And about 10 minutes later, this 50-year-old guy comes out wearing sandals, shorts, and T-shirt, walking towards Starbucks from Publix grocery store, and I said, that's the man.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, how do I know that? I said, I don't know. Well, we both got a very bad feeling, and I'm going to back up here a little bit. Starting last October, they've tried to kill some very decent, good people in the world. They tried to kill them numerous times, and through a series of events, it was revealed to me several Gambino Mafia retired hitmen, and I got these people warned. And in both cases, the first time, the guy would have been in bed in 25 minutes from the time I made the call till he got warned and he was able to get his bodyguards to protect him, and they killed three guys in his perimeter outside his mansion. Well, a week later, I went back to the same bar, and the same guy comes in, and he sits down next to me, and I said, I guess I got you in a lot of trouble. He says, how did you know we were going to kill such and such? I said, listen, you better get this through your head that that couldn't have come from me. That came from God. He says, what do you want to quit? And I told him the amount. And he says, I'm bringing it next week in suitcases. Or Wednesday in suitcases. I said, no. We're talking Swiss bank accounts. He said, meet me here. I'll be here Wednesday. I said, where are you from originally? And he said, Anderson, Ohio. And I said, I thought this guy was in his mid to late 50s by the way he looked. And I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 49. And I said, wait a minute. You were that skinny little kid in the corner with his bike when I was fighting a guy named John behind Anderson High School that was egged on by Bill and the Neil character. And the guy was pounding my head into a curb, concrete curb, in a headlock. And I told him, I said, if you do that one more time, you're dead. So he did it because he had control over me. And I stood up. Next thing I know, the kid's 12 feet above me, and he lands on his bike. And he was in a neck brace, and I think he broke his arm. I said, you are that skinny little kid. And this guy turned white. He said, you're very perceptive. And he backed out of the bar like you would a Clint Eastwood movie. So the following Wednesday, I'm waiting there for 3 hours, and I say, well, wait a minute, because I was Special Ops, Delta Force, Force Recon, SEAL, Ranger, Green Beret, and Air Force missions, unofficially, because I was never officially in the military, and I waited there for 3 hours, and I say, well, you know, all of us Special Ops personnel have GPS monitors somewhere inside. I said, well, they know where I'm at, when I'm at, and usually who I'm with. So I left. I came home. I had a mini panic attack. I got the first guy warned again, and then 15 minutes later, I had another mini panic attack, and then I got the second guy warned. And the first guy, he would have been dead 3 minutes later. The second guy would have been dead 30 minutes later. And I told these people how to find underground moles and perps when you don't, when you want to find them. You take reverse speech, which is a tape-recorded message of anyone, and play it backwards. You'll hear a portion of their thoughts or beliefs come out. If they're taking a lie detector test with a reverse speech machine and the highest dollar voice stress analyzers under armed guard, it's three-way fail-safe. You can't pass because they know if you're going to get caught, you're going to be tortured to death. And the more traumatized the individual is, the more comes out on all three. Now, after this gentleman was staring at us and I pointed him out, I asked you, I said, Roz, you think I should call and warn everybody? You remember that?
Yeah.
And so I called and warned. And the next Saturday, someone came to visit us to meet you, didn't they? Remember when the individual came and thanked you for saving
his... Yes, he came to thank me.
And he's a very connected individual.
We hit the right person.
And he spoke openly in front of you with me about a lot of classified things, didn't he? Well, not really classified, but the fact that the way you saved him. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, have you seen, in your search of the different religions, have you seen the same type techniques that they used in Jehovah's Witness Church with these other religious writings that you have received? Are you there, Roz?
Yes, but I really can't hear you.
Have you seen
I don't know what's happened, whether it's my phone or what.
Well, they're trying, you know, they're constantly pulling
I really can't hear you.
You can't hear me at all?
Very, very slight.
Let's try this. How about this, Roz? Can you hear
no.
me?
No. Oh, I can't hear you.
Well, we'll try on. You know an individual named Barry Kamish, don't you? Barry Kamish is a author.
I hear a word here and there, but that's it.
Tell us about Barry Kamish.
About what?
Barry Kamish. Barry. Oh, boy, the government's fooling with the telephone. I apologize to the listeners out there. They're constantly fooling with our phones because they don't want the information that I'm putting out here out.
They must be doing something with the phone because I heard you fine in the beginning. Now I can't hear you at all.
Can you hear me at all right now?
No, very, very slight.
Tell us about Barry Kamish.
Barry Kamish?
Yes.
Barry Kamish is a Israeli author, internationally known, has written some excellent books on the state of Israel and what is going on there politically, militarily, and because he tells the truth of what's really happened and the death of the Prime Minister Rabin, not with the story that was told to the public, but the real story, and feeling that this is the last days of Israel, he was not only threatened, but they did try to kill him several times, where his car was crashed. It crashed in his car. He had to have surgeries, and he knew that his death was imminent. They did everything to scare him and harm him. And so he moved to British Columbia, and he barely got in there. It was a relative that helped him get in there. And oh, you want me to tell a story about what happened with his wife?
Yes.
While he was living there, and he has an email list of which I was on, that's how I knew him. And while he was there, this woman wrote to him and told him she wants to convert to Judaism, and she would like to have his help. And he said, well, I really don't know how I can help you, you know, because he really doesn't know a great deal about religion or the Bible. He just loves Israel. He's lived there for 31 years. And then this disaster that happened to him, and so she made a trip to British Columbia and seduced him. And being a man, being tempted, he married this woman. And they moved to the same town that I live in. And we'd been in contact. And he said one day she told him that she's taking in her daughter and her boyfriend, who are 14 years old, to cohabit together in the apartment. And he had enough morality, and he said, absolutely not. This cannot be. So when he was away on tour, he gives tours and presentations, she stripped the entire apartment. She didn't even leave him a spoon to eat with, and took everything and relocated herself with her daughter and boyfriend and left him completely broke. She got rid of his green card, and so he's now an illegal alien in this country, and poor as can be, and I don't know what he's going to do.
Now, didn't his wife
we
also...
We think that she was set up, and it was you who mentioned it to me, and I mentioned it to him, and he said as he looks back now, he realizes that he was set up. No doubt, no. By one of the governments, the Israeli and the U.S. governments,
well,
set up with this woman.
She even took all of his books that he sells, and that's his only way of making a living. She was part of a group, some kind of Jewish group, that gave her a gun to kill herself.
Oh, yes.
Remember that?
She said that she was so desperate to be Jewish, that she went to a group called B'nai Elim, and they gave her a gun to go before the UN and shoot herself. They wanted to show what the religious right was like, that they were crazy. And they gave her a gun because they're trying to break down Israel from all their religion. And so that's what happened. So she didn't obviously shoot herself. And that's when he should have gotten wise that they put her up to this.
Now, when she left him left him penniless and without a green card.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When she took all of his books and everything else, the only help he's been able to get is what little you've been able to do for him. Is that correct?
That I didn't hear.
Well, the viewers or the listeners heard that. See, Barry has done extensive research in Israel, and his books basically show that most of the Israelis that are dying at night, where there are no witnesses, are being killed by the Mossad and the IDF forces.
Yeah.
So they can control the people's opinion. And that's what they do. And Barry claims to know that they are, quite a few of them are Illuminati that are running Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they're involved in the same neo-Nazi crap that the Jews that put Hitler in power were involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you've shown me the Israeli pictures of this Israeli Supreme Court building and their Justice Center. And it's laid out like Washington. Everything is a satanic front with all the three tiers, the way it's laid out. It's Masonic. It's satanic. Israel's leadership is very much involved in this new world order. And the Israel may be going to war with Iran very soon. That is a very real threat. Because I know that in the United States, let's see, that would have been 2 months, I guess it would have been in February, we were at DEFCON 2, about to go to war with China and Iran, and then we were at DEFCON 2 as well, right before that earthquake a month ago in China. So the world is a much scarier place than what they want to let on. Syria has nuclear warheads. There's the 100 missing suitcase nukes. When did they go, when and where did they go missing? December of 86, when I was over there with the Mujahideen, every time they would get stuck on their military tactics, when the Russians had changed, they'd send me over there to unstick them, the Southern Tribe. And so the last mission I went on, Russians were all at siege mentality. They wouldn't go outside their fortifications. So we attacked the farthest out fortification, and they radio into another fortification and says, we're being attacked. Come help us. They said, no, you come help us. Because we had Russian communication equipment and we had numerous Muslim defectors that were Russian communication tech people, we knew what they were saying to each other. So we overtook the fortification, stripped all the dead from their bodies, and put them on. So we radioed the next fortification. He said, we're coming to you. We're overrun and we're coming to you. But the Mujahideen is right on our tails. So we got about 300 guys in Russian uniforms, and we got five guys in the distance on Arabian horses waving their swords around in the distance chasing us. This might sound corny, but the Russians were so scared that it worked. So as we jumped the wall to this fortification, we took it very quickly. And this location had a lot of Russian trucks. So we radioed to an armored base that had a lot of tanks. They says, we're being attacked and we're being overrun. Send help. And they said, we're sending you an armored column along the way. So we all piled in the back of these Russian trucks with have the canvas over the backs. And we say, they're attacking us. We're driving to you. We're being overrun. And so we drove up alongside of this long Russian column, had quite a few tanks. And when we got by all the tanks, we pulled the drapes on the canvas truck, Molotov cocktailed the tanks, and took the formation very quickly. And I even met a Polish guy that was over there at a gym a year and a half ago, and he was supposed to be on that armored column, but he was sick, and he got out right away. Otherwise, he would have been dead. And so the last three trucks in that column, the one at the very end had the 100 missing suitcase of Russian nukes. They're all 1985 Russian issue. None of them were GPS monitored. And that's where the 100 missing suitcase nukes came from. And I'm the only American, and I can't tell 1,100 Mujahideen, you can't keep these things. So I said, be careful with these things. And the two trucks in front of it were full of suitcase biobombs. So not only that we have the 100 missing suitcase nukes to worry about, we have to worry about those 200 Russian suitcase biobombs. Now, if they were smart enough to take the radioactive material out of those suitcase nukes so it didn't fry the electronics, and they were able to replenish it and replace the vacuum tubes, because none of the Russian stuff was solid state, it was all vacuum tube, that they would in fact be able to have an active suitcase nuke again. Now, has Barry talked about anything about those suitcase nukes with you, Roslyn? The suitcase nukes that Russia lost, has Barry said anything to you about that? I guess you can't hear because they're screwing with the phones. This is what they do. I hope the listeners can bear with us, because the government on a regular basis won't let me talk to people. They'll turn my cell phone on, off. I'll be in a high receiver area, and I have no reception, while everybody else seems to be able to talk on their cell phones. And this is the type of thing they do. And in my case, they're in and out of my house all the time. Can't stop it. Can't afford to get the electronic gear. They can bypass any electronic surveillance system very easily. If they want in your house and you have something that they want, it doesn't matter whether you have guard dogs or whatnot, unless you've got a little army there, they're going to get in your house. They have sound guns. They can point at an attack dog and put it to sleep. They can bypass any electronic surveillance system that we have, because they have the best that there is. And they will do whatever they want because they have no accountability. Just as Roz was describing earlier in Jackson Township, the politicians do whatever they want because there's no accountability. And they have their corruption. You have the drug trade, which funds all this, the sanctioned drug trade. The war on drugs is the war on the unsanctioned drugs. And under the great humanitarian Jimmy Carter, we did this little mission in Nicaragua in December of 77 called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. There were 12 drug cartel heads in Colombia at that time. Now, Barry Kamish told me that Israel was the one actually in charge of this, and the CIA gets the drugs. It first goes through Mossad's hands first, but we were taking out the seven lesser drug lords to consolidate five under Pablo Escobar, under the Mossad and the CIA, under the authorization of the great humanitarian Jimmy Carter. The first guy we took out had a handle of Benito Mussolini. He got his head blown off. The second guy we took out was a drug dealer went by Mr. Green Jeans. One called himself the Frito Bandito. One was the commander, which was a former Nazi commander. Another was Joseph Mangula's financial assistant, who also was an FSS officer. And finally, we paid a visit to Uncle Joe, Joseph Mangula. And we sliced and diced him all night long. I mean, Joseph Mangula was not in very good shape when we left. It's possible he could have lived, but he would have been have no arms, no legs past the knees. He had no ears, no one eye, no tongue, no nose, and it's possible they could have moved him to Brazil where they said he died. Now, and let's go to Pablo Escobar. Pablo Escobar was ordered out of the drug trade by George Bush Sr., from what I'm told. And he could no longer make money making cocaine. So Pablo Escobar decided to make money. Now, that guy that died in Medellin in 93 was a body double. That wasn't Pablo Escobar. Pablo Escobar was at his hacienda out somewhere out in the countryside in Colombia. Exactly where, I don't know, because I usually didn't know where I was other than the general area. And he got his hands on U.S. mint paper and ink. And he almost got his hands on $100 Philadelphia mint plates. And that's why he was ordered to be taken out. And so that's why they changed the money, by the way. They changed the money back in the mid-90s because of Pablo Escobar to try to make it so it cannot be harder to counterfeit. And North Korea and some of these other nations do a very good job of counterfeiting U.S. money to destroy the economy. So we went down there, and I guess it was about a 500-meter range. We're having a shootout with Pablo at his hacienda, and he had an AK-74, I had a Remington M16 long rifle series 5, which is caliber 273, and all my rounds were armor piercing. So we're having this shootout, and he was in his adobe mansion, and so firing from a window, so I just put rounds all the way around the window when we got him. When we went in to go inside, he was still alive, and I did my best to give him Catholic last rites, and our orders were to kill his family, and he got us to promise we wouldn't kill his family, and I did. So after he died, the Walking Arsenal, who trained me, says, well, let's go kill the family. I said, no, we're not going to do that. And he puts his hand on his 45, and I put my hand on a bayonet I got on my left arm, special ops bayonet knife, and I told him, I says, you'll never make it. I said, in fact, we're leaving, and you're going to take point. And I had a sawed-off Winchester pump, and I cocked it, and I followed this man for hours, writing him, saying, then this is at a mind-control state, keep in mind, how can God forgive us? We've wiped out countless villages, women, children, tortured numerous people to death, and the United States does torture people when they need to get information, and sometimes they just do it just to do it. And this is how the real world works. And this was what was going on down there in Nicaragua. Now, the CIA brings up the sanctioned cocaine, and as long as all their sanctioned drug dealers deal with sanctioned cocaine, nobody gets busted. And that's the way the real world works. Rosalind, are you still with me?
I am. I couldn't hear a great deal of it, but it just hurts me so much that the world is so unaware of what's really happening.
Well, Rosalind and I, we're risking our lives. And neither one of us are afraid of them trying to kill us to get the truth out there. And in my case, I've been promised by a high-ranking government official twice that they're going to get me a settlement so I can have a normal life for the first time in my life. Because there are so many churches, like Worldwide Church of God, like the Jehovah Witness Church, like the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I've been told that more than half the ministers in this country are, in fact, Illuminati, Jesuit, CIA, Mafia, FBI, or Satanic priests. And I found that big time in Worldwide Church of God when I started using the reverse speech machine on sermon tapes. And I would encourage everyone out there to go to David John Oates' reverse speech or reversespeak.com. Learn about it. Get yourself a machine or software. Start running sermon tapes through it and find out what these people really are. Now, but don't do it to your wife or your husband, because you won't be married for very long. Because what comes out on the reverse speech tape machine is mostly from the subconscious mind, and we all think very sexually. You know, and I don't pay attention to any reversals I get, say, boy, I'd like to really do such and such and such and such. The only time I pay attention to them is when I get reversals of, I did this and I did that. Then I would pay attention. And this is how I found everything. And this is, and I believe this is part of what the Bible says in the end times. The secret, everything made secret shall be made known openly. And I believe this is part of what it is. Because these people run around like a mole rat colony, hiding in their shadow, their influence, their insider trading. And that's how they make their money. And when a disaster occurs, like Katrina, which I've been told was caused by HARP Project, and it probably was, while everybody's in shock, these trained operatives are running around buying up businesses and properties and commodities at bargain basement prices while everyone else is in shock. This is how these guys stay in power, make more money, and it doesn't matter whether it's a contrived disaster, a contrived war, a contrived financial crisis, or one that God allows to occur, they're out there making more money each time. They don't care about the American people. They don't care about their parishioners. All they want, they think their job in life is to take everything we got, destroy us, and then end up richer. And I'm sure you've seen that happen in Jackson, New Jersey. Is that correct, Roz?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this is the way the political machine works. But a number of
you know, at one time, I called the FBI because of what was going on there. It was so illegal. And when he came to my house, the agent, he said to me, you know, he said, we are not the old FBI, and we can't go rushing into anything. He said, you have to catch them in the act. He said, but if you did, I want you to know that your life would never be the same. They will be after you and your children for the rest of your life. So
note, Roslyn, we're out of time, and I thank you for being my guest, and I will see you a little bit later. This is Eugene B. Colson at Mind Controlled America. If you wish to contact me, email me at eugenebcullson@yahoo.com. And I want to thank Donald Newsom and the BBS Internet Radio Network for allowing me to have this show. It's Eugene B. Colson signing off. Take care.